Recently, I got a call from a man in the South. He said his name was Jeff B., and he was a big fan of WNPR.
I consider every word that Harriet Jones says to be gospel. You know what I miss? The real-life survival guide with Bruce Barber. They didn't give that a fair chance. Hey, how's Jeff Tyson working out as the new producer for Lucy Nalpathanchel? I noticed Lori Mack hosts Morning Edition on Fridays. She has a sweet voice. I bet she's a nice person. Down where I live, there ain't hardly anybody who knows about Diwali Sakautau or Ophabia Quist Arkton or Nell Greenfield Boyce or Yuki Noguchi or nothing. I think that Chris Thaley
I started to enjoy my conversations with Jeff B. It's nice when somebody pays attention, but some of Jeff B.'s ideas were a little weird.
Pea turkeys. I found out the Large Hadron Collider was built for the express purpose of awakening an Egyptian god. You can go ahead and tell Mr. Patrick Scahill about that. I have information about Jay-Z being a time-traveling vampire, which I emailed to John Dankosky, but he didn't do nothing, possibly because there wasn't no Vermont or Rhode Island angle. You know, the Denver airport ain't no real airport. It's some kind of hell.
Jeff B. was eager to have me look into some of this. He wanted me to come down to where he was and maybe check out some of these rumors. He said I might get an addictive podcast out of it.
When the cast of Saved by the Bell murdered Hunter S. Thompson, the people I work with is as mean as snakes and dumber than rocks. That's just how they are, and I reckon they're up to their bridges in some of the conspiracies I've been telling you about. This place is poop town. That's why I need you to...
Excuse me, stop. Mr. Sessions, General Sessions, Attorney Sessions, what am I supposed to call you? I just can't drop everything I'm doing and go down to D.C.?
You have to. I ain't doing so good here. I got mixed up with some bad folks. I told you, this is poop town. It's doo-doo city. It is number two-ville. Oh, no. I think that Steve Bannon fella is walking down the hall right at me, mad as a bull.
So I decided to go. The thing is that I'd grown fond of Jefferson Beauregard Sessions, this lonely, peculiar man, frightened of marijuana users and dogged by paranoid visions. The story I would uncover was not the one I expected. It had Russians and cyber criminals and a strange man named Devin, plus a volatile figure known as Spicy. Doo Doo City changed me, and that change started right when I checked in at the Pooptown Best Western and found sitting on my bed a blonde woman with her legs and feet tucked under her as she looked at her phone. Her name was Colin McEnroe.
That's right. Well, if you've been listening to S-Town, that will sound a lot funnier to you than it probably did otherwise. But you can catch up. You'll get it eventually. All right. So we're here today on The Nose with Jim Chapdelaine, Emmy Award-winning musician, producer, composer, recording engineer, and a patient advocate for people with rare cancers, Teresa Kramer, writer, editor of E-Content magazine, and founding editor of The Cut, an online magazine for disgruntled adults of Connecticut, and Kate Rushen, a Pushcart Prize-nominated poet and editor and writer and a teaching artist for the Connecticut Humanities. And so we're going to begin by talking about S-Town. S-Town is a somewhat awaited and anticipated product by more or less the creative team and producing team behind This American Life and Serial, although it is specifically the work of a producer named Brian Reed, who you don't know probably from any of those things. The New York Times writes, some Serial fans may be disappointed to learn that the crew's latest offering is not a straightforward whodunit. They shouldn't be. S-Town turns out to be much more interesting than that. S-Town is not another tale of a journalist trying to solve a murder with just a microphone and a little elbow grease, and thank God. Instead, S-Town transcends the podcast procedural with a destabilizing narrative structure which one small town mystery leads to another, all surrounding Mr. McLemore and his acquaintances. There is that murder, but also a treasure hunt, a land grab, and a mysterious benefactor. Mr. Reed's investigation turns psychological and emotional into how people come to be branded as bad and the hidden relationships among men in the rural South. Well, that's about as far as we could go without a spoiler. We're trying not to spoil anything, and there's like one of the big spoilers comes in episode 2 of 7 episodes, so we have to sort of dance around certain things. But Teresa, I know you were, you know, as big a fan of Serial as there could be. Mm-hmm. You and I went to see live Serial at the Bushnell. And so I knew that you would devour this right away, which mm-hmm. you did. I think, did you do it in one day?
I did it in one day.
Yeah.
I work from home, so I either listen to the radio or podcast while I'm listening anyway. So it was basically a work day full of this podcast for me.
And going into it with the expectation that it'll be the next Serial mm-hmm. is both a good thing and a bad thing, because it isn't that, but there's something pleasing about the fact that it doesn't try to.
Right. You know, I think, but what people liked about Serial, they will also like about this to some degree, because, there was no satisfactory ending to Serial. I think this actually has a much more satisfactory ending. And the second season of Serial was kind of blah, right? So if you wanted something as compelling as that first season, I think this is a much better attempt at that than season 2 of actual Serial.
I just want to record it. I really liked the second season of Serial, but I guess I'm probably a little bit of a minority. It certainly didn't deliver the oomph of Serial. Kate, one of the things that you talked about as we were getting ready for this is, I mean, they dropped all 7 episodes at once, which you, I think, thought was a good thing in the sense that not everything about the first episode or two made you think about committing yourself to a lifetime of 7 episodes.
That's right. I'll confess it right here. This is the first podcast I've ever binged listened to. And I would have stopped about 40 minutes in if it hadn't been an assignment, because I could feel John B.'s manipulation and wanting to be at the center of attention and looking down his nose at other people, using his intelligence and his knowledge to kind of put down other people. And about 40 minutes in, I'm like, I think he called the guy under false pretenses, Brian Reed. And so I would have stopped, and I'm glad I didn't, because I could not have predicted anything it turned out to be.
So, Jim, she's talking about John B. McLemore. He is the focus of this series. A genius, a crank, a polymath, a man with a really confusing personal life, a man obsessed with climate change and economic apocalypse. And I'm still not describing him very well because he's very hard to describe. I think we all kind of know somebody a little bit like this who kind of makes a point of not fitting in and has almost legendary powers of some kind, intellectual powers. But in another way, we don't know anybody like John B.
Because John B. is cloaked in the veneer of Southern rural manhood of some sort. And maybe because he's such a contrarian, he's contrary to everything. I have to say, this is the first podcast that I committed to. Teresa got my wife hooked on some murdering podcast where women like a coffee klatch murder thing.
My favorite murder,
right. And I listened to it for a while. I was like, no, this is not for me. But this, unlike Kate, I was pretty hooked. And I was hooked initially because I'm a sucker for dialect and accents. And his is profoundly entertaining. I agree, he's totally manipulative. And you could sort of sense that early on. But just the breathy, the here, the H's is breathy. Mm-hmm. And the vowels are so drawn out in the yard. When he's out in the yard and he has to take a Tums, all the vowels are like 5 times what we, and especially in contrast with the reporter, Brian Reed, who's basically a white liberal Yankee who talks like we do, right? Mm-hmm. So there's some intrigue and exotica that's embedded in this Southern culture on the skids narrative.
Jim's done an impressive I was trying to kind of capture the way John B. McLemore talked when I was recording that intro, and I couldn't do it. It's not a typical Southern accent, and we're going to play a little bit of it just so people can hear this voice that threads its way through all 7 episodes.
This whole area needs to be defined. You know, if you look at the demographics charts of the state of Alabama and go over the poorest counties, Bibb County is maybe the 5th worst county to live in. we are one of the child molester capitals of the states. We have just an incredible amount of police corruption. We have the poorest education. We've got 95 churches in this damn county. We only have two high schools, no secondary education, and we got Jeebus, because Jeebus is coming, and global warming is a hoax. You know, there's no such thing as climate change and all that. Yeah, I'm in an area that just hasn't advanced, for lack of a better word. I don't have to eat a Tums here. Sorry about that. Oh, it's one of those awful cherry-flavored ones. That would be the first one to hop out.
Is your stomach bothering you?
Oh, I have constant acid reflux. You know, I've had it all my life.
So why, can you tell me, why did you email me?
Well, you know, the original reason, which I gave you, was just some of the things I had heard about, you know, some of the goings-on down here.
All right, so that's John B. McLemore talking to Brian Reed. Brian Reed is to S-Town what Sarah Koenig was to Serial. He is our moderator and our narrator and our guide through the underworld, John B. McLemore, who's this man who's kind of contacted him out of the blue and asked him if he would come down and try to solve a murder, which is not something you necessarily do with a stranger. He's the person who becomes this object of fascination for us. I think it's fair to say, although there are a lot of things that we're trying to understand here, Teresa, in this mm-hmm. podcast, mostly we're trying to understand this very, very complicated man.
Yeah, and I think during our emails, one of the things I wrote to you guys about was that I'd read this this review of the movie Hell or High Water, which is sort of a complicated it's a movie about two brothers from Texas basically trying to save their family farm.
My favorite last year. Yeah. My favorite movie.
It was a very good movie. And one of the things that review said is that we need more complicated stories about the South, right? We just get stereotypes most of the time. And we get a lot of stereotypes here. People confirm stereotypes, but John at the same time is just blowing them out of the water left and right. And so you don't really... So it's hard to get a grasp on him so often, and he does these things that sometimes seem contradictory to what he says. He does things that are contradictory to what he says or the values that he espouses, right? So you're just constantly trying to figure out what his deal is.
I have spent a good deal of time in Alabama where this thing is set, and one thing that I was reminded just listening to it is the cadence of the way that people talk. And it's not just the accent, and it's not even just the choice of words. They really do speak in a kind of pentameter or something. It's like they're trying the dumbest poop kicker, you know, who appears in this, and there are plenty to choose from in this radio documentary. When he talks, you can almost hear him reflexively adding, you know, a couple of syllables, usually the word effin', just in order to make the sentence spill out with a particular rhythm here.
Damn, but, also.
Right, damn.
Everything is damn.
Everything's damn.
Everything.
Everything's damn.
Damn podcast.
But, you know, Kate, this is something that you brought up, and I think I had sort of the same thought, which is that it's hard to make 7 hours or so of programming about a small town in Alabama and talk so little about race. Now, mostly this town is something like 93% white, I think we're told near the end. But really, there's, I think, one moment in episode 2 where they're in this kind of back room of a club with a bunch of people who seem like the same people who are in Dwight Yoakam's band in Sling Blade. And there's one guy who really professes himself to be a white supremacist and kind of lays it all out. And then you pretty much don't hear about race until the last 15 minutes of this. And I found that to be odd. Just having spent time in Alabama, it's just so much there in the coding of the place.
Yeah, I found that odd too. I was in Alabama this past summer, and the history of buying and selling men, women, and children is right there in your face, along with the long, dark roads and the isolation. And I found Brian Reed's choice not to do more about the racial dynamics odd, because there is so much excruciating detail about other parts of John B.'s life. And he tells us that John B. has some of the same attitudes that he expresses about African Americans and women But Brian Reed decides not to let us hear John B. speak about that in his own words. And I did find that very odd.
Yeah, I mean, in the final episode, there's a former town clerk who's talking about the turnip green suppers, you know. Mm-hmm. They have these turnip green suppers. And I had this sudden flash, too, because I used to be down in Alabama with my wife's family, who are lovely people, and we're from – part of the family's from Mobile. And we'd go down to Gulf Shores, which is called the Redneck Riviera. And I was the cook, so I would – we had a big, huge bunch of people in a beach house, and I was the cook, and I'd just drive up inland a little bit and look for kind of a truck farmy kind of place. And so one day I happened to find at a little sort of kind of like a farmer's market some collard greens, and I like collard greens. I like cooking collard greens, so I got a couple bags of them. I brought them back, and all the Southerners looked at them. And there was like this very awkward moment. And finally they explained to me that in the South, white people eat turnip greens and black people eat collard greens. And they were uncomfortable with this. I mean, they were like really uncomfortable. And then they said, well, it's Colin. You know, of course we're going to eat it. Of course we're going to eat what he cooks. But it was like they had to overcome something pretty big to do this. Now, think about that.
Well, that's interesting, the idea of overcoming, because I think John B.'s story at its heart is a man who's trying to overcome his entire life, basically. Yeah. He's trying to fight his way out of this town unsuccessfully. He's trying to change the town unsuccessfully. He's trying to change people's minds more or less unsuccessfully. And so we see him fail in a lot of different ways. But to me, sort of like the sort of Southern white guy failing at not being a racist is a thing we've heard 1,000 times. And, you know, the Southern white guy failing at teaching his town about climate change is not something we've heard 1,000 times, you know. So it's like it's just a little more compelling.
Yeah, I'd push back a little bit on 2 points. One, I don't think John is even remotely trying to leave the town. I think he's trying to change the town in earnest, but I don't know who – I don't know that I understand who he is fully, having listened to those. And to Kate's point about the race part, I totally agree that it's there. I think what this is a much more microscopic look where Brian Reed, the narrator, reporter, has chosen to zoom in past those things, giving a slight acknowledgement to them. And giving us a glimpse of the fork in the road that happened when, in the post-slavery world, we see white Jim Crow stuff happening and poor white people being placed as oppositional to African Americans. And that dynamic plays out over a century or two and exacerbates racism when, in fact, that culture is being dictated by plantation owners and farmers who are saying, you know, if it wasn't for the grace of God, you would be in the position of that black man. And these are those guys. And he's zoomed past that into a little more microscopic look at who these people are. Well, So that's just my take on it.
I hear what you're saying, but I don't think
it's right or wrong. It's just I think an editorial choice.
I feel like
made.
There are these kind of like ghosts of the –
No doubt.
Convict farm laborers and the lynching victims. And Reed has this conversation with the wealthy lumber owner.
Oh, well, he would be one of the perpetrators
of this,
right? And the
name of his company is K3. And Reed brings up the name and says, oh, is this a reference to a certain white supremacist group? And the guy kind of laughs at him and says, well, it doesn't bother me. So my point is, why would he bring it up?
He says, I suppose you're one of those liberals upset.
Lefties.
Yeah, lefties that we upset in the most recent national election. That's what he says.
And then he says, I don't have a problem with the echo.
And there is the graffiti that you're stumbling across.
Yeah.
With KKK stuff everywhere.
Right. And my question is if Reed was going to point that out, it just seemed like kind of a offhanded way to challenge the owner about the name. And why, when there's so much else going on?
Well, sure.
In terms of why, I think it shows us where John B. came from, right? Like he's growing up around all of this stuff and he's not he's not perfect at getting past it, but he's tried to some extent. And he,
they talk about his evolution, that he used to be sort of an openly racist person.
Right. And there's also, he's sort of been the outcast around here himself for reasons that I'm not sure whether or not we're allowed to spoil. But
let's try not to spoil anything.
Okay. So,
but in a way, though, I feel like we're cheating people of how much fun and how interesting this thing is.
Yeah.
Because, but anyway, go ahead.
Well, it's brilliant.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. I mean, the production is brilliant. The music is great. The way the narrative unfolds just keeps you going.
And the contrast between, I think it's Brian Reed is ironically named because his voice is this reedy little thing. I almost feel like sometimes he's on the verge of tears, but it's not. It's just an affect of the way he speaks, contrasted with the sort of poetic way that we as sort of Yankees perceive Southern dialect. I mean, there's a reason we listen to a lot of music from the South. There is a poetry inherent in both the cadence and this drawn-out vowel, breathy H way that they talk. It's almost like Russ Cole. And we start, you know, not to get too convoluted, but the first couple of episodes, I feel like I'm headed straight to Carcosa.
Right. So I think that one thing, Teresa, that he gets really well, and I think one of the things that he is exploring is, okay, I'm going to generalize grotesquely about the difference between the North and the South. But in the North, we all are kind of repressed and, you know, we're not that friendly sometimes. We don't talk about our feelings that much, whatever. In the South, it's very different. And people are often very friendly and very ingratiating and cheerful. But I'll tell you just a quick story. So my significant other was down visiting in another part of the South and went over and visited a couple of adult sisters that were known to the family she was visiting. She came back and she said, well, I was just over at the Farthingale or whatever their names are, sisters. They're so lovely. They're so nice. And one of the women in the house said, oh, they're mean as snakes. That's just how we are, though. You know, and that's, you know, there's that famous sort of, you know, bless her heart. She just couldn't be fatter, you know. But one of the things that the people in the South do is that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things that Brian Reed does in a very interesting way, he's a remarkable interrogator. He's like this guy who just kind of hangs around and you just keep expecting someone to hit him or make him go away.
He's so neutral about everything I mean, I'm sure there's judgment in what he's doing because he has to make a decision. But he doesn't give that judgment away.
And there are moments where someone that he's been having relatively polite conversations with will suddenly say something that's shockingly violent, will suggest defacing a corpse in a particularly alarming way, or will suggest cutting the fingers off of somebody else. A person that he's had a pretty cordial relationship will suddenly just demonstrate these really kind of shockingly violent impulses.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's done a really remarkable job that way of peeling back the onion of Southern cordiality.
Yeah, I like you, I've spent some time in the South on some road trips. And, you know, I find the same thing, right? That people are very outgoing, right? And they will talk to you just at the drop of a hat. But often you talk to them for a couple minutes and they're either shocking or rude in some way. You know, like they will often accuse you because you're from the North of being rude. That's one of the things, you know, like just to your face. Or I was once in Tennessee and a man I was talking to was like, oh, so you're from one of those blue states, huh? And I was just like, well, we were talking about cars, but thanks for bringing that up right now. I was just having a pleasant conversation. And so that really rang true to me, this sort of like, if you can get, there's a difference between being outgoing and willing to talk to anybody and truly being a kind, friendly, open person, right?
Jim, one thing I wanted to ask you, I wanted to sort of come back to that you were just bringing up. So you were mentioning Russ Cole. Russ Cole is the character played by Matthew McConaughey in the first season of True Detective, and famously a man who he is a little bit like John B. McLemore in the sense that he doesn't necessarily present as a great as a highly educated man. John B., who just exudes brilliance, was not a person who was able to function in college at all or get an actual education. But Russ, who's this, you know, police detective, will start talking about time being a flat circle and everything you ever did, you're doing all right. You know, and this thing is also a real meditation on time. And as it goes on towards episodes 6 and 7, this community of horologists, these people who study time and work on clocks there in the Deep South, and who and John B., who it is a meditation on time at a certain point.
I actually wrote that down, that it is a melancholy take on the passage of time, and that he's incredibly articulate about not only the mechanics of clocks and but actually the passage of time, and it's clearly weighing on him as he reflects on his life. The passage of time seems to be one of the things that preoccupies him most at some fundamental level of who he is, and how to spend that time, how to literally calculate the amount of time you have, and how are you supposed to spend that.
And speaking of time, Kate, I do feel like we did this way too fast. We binged these episodes as quickly as we could. They all dropped on Tuesday. We've got through 7 hours of them while leading the rest of our lives, more or less. And I do feel like this is something that we might want to take some time to have settle in. You know, even how can I say this without doing a spoiler? I know I can do it. But it turns out that John B.'s interest in time and clocks is tied to his fate. In a way that is, doesn't become evident until the final episode, but it's
That was pretty good. That was pretty good. You didn't spoil anything.
Yeah. I shouldn't say another word here, but like that's something that I would really like to think about a little longer. You know.
Yeah, you know, someone in the podcast mentions some of the Southern writers. Some who are called Southern Gothic writers. And, you know, I grew up very intrigued by O'Connor and Carson McCullers and the very first Truman Capote, Other Voices, Other Rooms. And they mention Demosa Pont and Poe. And I do love the way that we've got these sundials and clocks and all this symbolism that's actually part of his life. And I was also struck by this whole idea of plating things, gilding objects that aren't very valuable to make them appear to be more valuable than they are. I was fascinated by this personally because my dad was an electroplater, and he actually used to silver plate Kennedy dollars. Mm-hmm. And put them on a chain and give them as gifts. So I was quite fascinated by the way that imagery and that reality entered the story and added to this whole sense of this Southern Gothic. And it made me question, well, what is that? What is Southern Gothic? And how is it different from American Gothic? How is it different from something that might happen in Eastern Connecticut?
We have to move on. I have to be John B. McLemore and note the time and say we have to move on here. But yeah, I think Southern Gothic's right on point. I will quickly say that my favorite Southern Gothic character is a man named Uncle Jimmy, who has a bullet in his head from an unfortunate encounter. And he's kind of in the background. He's never really on mic. He's usually in the background going, yeah, buku stuff. He's good buku stuff.
The buku really got me. I was like, that's the word you've held on to, Uncle Jimmy? Yeah, buku?
Buku. Yeah. All right, we don't have buku time right here. We got to take a break. We'll come back. We'll talk about other things. All right. Welcome back. This is The Nose with Teresa Kramer, Kate Rushen, and Jim Chapdelaine. The Nose, like any other show that we do, gets posted with all the audio up at WNPR.org/Colin. You're going to want to look because I assume we will include pictures of the leggings that Teresa is wearing today.
Kate's got hers on,
Kate,
too.
Kate
claims that she's
got
hers.
You did that quick change.
No, she took her jeans off. Oh, they were really on under there.
She went legging on us.
I'm taking mine off next.
All right. So why are we talking about leggings? Maybe you know about this. It was kind of an internet sensation, but United Airlines refused admission onto an airplane for two teenage girls who were traveling a pass. It was sort of they have a system like all airlines do where employees and their families can fly for free if there's empty seats. But it turns out that employees and their families, even teenage girls who are their families, have to follow the United Dress Code. The United Dress Code does not permit leggings. So they were refused admission, and really kind of all hell broke loose. And Jim, you were saying that the only thing that this really taught you is how easy it is to stir up a tornado on the internet.
It's to me, the subject of leggings, well, it could not be any less interesting than anything in my life right now. I can't imagine anything less interesting than this legging story, except that it's a perfect symptom of the age of rage. And the displaced rage. I mean, there's places that we should be plenty outraged about, and we are.
You sound like John B. McLemore.
That's right. Yeah. Maybe it's seeping in. I hope not too much of it. Teresa and I have been meeting with our Indivisible group, and I open every meeting and I say, look, if this is a movement fueled on outrage, we have to pace ourselves, but you can expect to be given a daily dose. And so far, we have not been let down. But if you're living in a constant state of rage alert and you just see a story flash across your newsfeed and go, damn it, what do you mean they can't wear leggings? Retweet, 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 outrage, outrage, outrage. Boy, now I'm a feminist. It's easy to infer a lot from this, right? But it's an airline policy. People are traveling free. And it turns out to me to be pretty much a non-story, except how people are easily outraged.
Well, people had some fun with this, too. The other airlines offered various kinds of deals to people and made a big deal of the fact that you can fly on their particular airline with leggings.
Except that, right, they too have the same policy for people traveling on those passes. It's just that
you have to follow the dress code.
Right.
The dress code for traveling, right.
Yeah. But the dress code, their dress code does not include leggings.
Oh, really?
No. I'm relying, I think, on Vanessa.
The only thing that scared me at first was my normal travel outfit is leggings and thigh-high leather boots and an infinity scarf. So I was worried when I first saw this, but then I realized I'm not employed by an airline, so I'm good.
Well, Vanessa Friedman, writing in the New York Times, says, you know, well, leggings are the excuse or the symbol, but to focus on them, which so much of the discussion has done since the news of the United ban broke, is to miss the point. The question at the heart of the issue is not whether leggings are appropriate for planes. The question is, as in all discussions of dress code, who gets to decide, the individual or the group, the individual or the business? She suggests that United was saying in its dress code, when you fly on our dime, you are representing our brand, and our brand takes flying with a certain amount of formality, the way it used to be taken. The flip side of this, I think, Kate, is that whole idea that there are companies that can and have, and rather controversially, say to women, well, high heels are part of our dress code. You have to wear high heels. You know, you can't wear the shoes of your choice. So in a way, what was happening was the dress code of United, which was something very familiar to their staff, suddenly got flung at some teenage girls, and it looked a little different when that happened.
And I'm wondering, was this really directed at the girls, or was this really directed at the guys who might start wearing leggings on flights?
Let's ask Colin. Do you often wear leggings when you travel?
I had to really think hard. We were having a staff meeting about this and talking about this as we got ready for the show, talking about the show to be way back on Monday. And I had to think about whether I knew what leggings were exactly.
And were leggings in vogue when they made this rule?
I was telling Jim this story last night. My boyfriend was putting
leggings on.
He's putting laundry in the washing machine.
He's a jester.
And yeah. I refused to get up and help because my cat was sitting on my lap. So he was just yelling to me from the washing machine about what could go in the washer and what couldn't. And he said, what about these leggings? And I was like, what leggings? And he went on for a while and described them to me. And I was like, oh, those are yoga pants. Those aren't leggings. And he was just like, I don't think there's a difference. But to me, there is very clearly a difference because leggings to me are not pants, right? They're sort of a step above tights. Mm-hmm. They're like this thing that was made to go under something else. And if I can see your butt like while you're wearing them, I don't approve.
So it sounds like you actually would prefer
you
that people
go to high school.
That people in leggings were not thrusting their butts in your faces. They made their way down the aisle of a Boeing.
Yeah, I mean, do you remember a few years ago there was a Lululemon scandal because their yoga pants were see-through?
That's right.
Right.
Well,
that's
then don't wear see-through pants out in public of your own accord if you have a problem with these yoga pants being see-through. Like, well, it doesn't make any sense.
Do you have a different feeling about jeggings? I actually got a pair of jeggings.
Well, those
that have
are made
pockets,
to be pants.
So they feel a little more formal.
Yeah.
Yes. And those are made to be pants, right? But like the leggings I have on today are pretty hefty. I didn't buy them for myself, but I suspect that they might be made for like exercise. So they're not quite so see-through. But I have pairs that are they are clearly not pants. They need to be worn under a skirt, a dress, a long shirt, long sweater, whatever. But I would never go out in public in like a t-shirt and these pants. And not everyone has that rule for themselves.
Well, I think the other thing that's being asked, Jim, is what is a plane? What is the sort of seating space in a plane, which used to be also a somewhat formal place? You and I are old enough to remember that you kind of used to even kind of get a little dressed up to go on an airplane.
Sure.
Wow, you're going on an airplane. You know, now people do dress with the idea that maybe they're going to sleep, maybe they're going to create this little nest for themselves.
Right.
So maybe even a person like Teresa, who wouldn't wear, say, leggings to a restaurant, is thinking, well, I'm not really in a restaurant. I'm in this place where I'm going to kind of just snuggle with myself.
Or if you're traveling by yourself, sometimes you want to dress as repulsively as you can to dissuade somebody from sitting next to you if it's not a full flight so that you can, in fact, stretch out during the flight.
Yeah.
So you might want to be unshaven and unkempt and not having bathed for a while. That's one of my strategies.
I have a big pile of used handkerchiefs that I put in the middle seat there and I just blow my nose on them, just like John B. McLemore.
That's so John B.
So John B. All right, do we have time to talk about the Pences? I guess we could quickly do this, right? I don't know.
I will say that Teresa and I had a meeting yesterday.
You had a meeting about the Pences?
No, just the two
rules.
Of us, not with our spouses or significant
oh.
others.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, and we talked about we have a I wouldn't call it a we have a political venture that we're sharing, and we had a meeting about it. There was no wine involved. There was nothing inappropriate. It was
there was a large piece of pizza.
All right,
yes,
we have to contextualize this. In 2002, Mike Pence told The Hill that he never eats alone with a woman other than his wife, and he won't attend events featuring alcohol without his wife, Karen Pence, by his side. And this is
she his counselor?
Sponsor? No, I think this goes back to it's a rule that he has borrowed from Billy Graham. Who had the same relationship with his wife, Ruth. And I think what Billy Graham was thinking at the time is, you know, ministers kind of can get in trouble and famous pastors can get in trouble. And we all lived through Jimmy Swaggart and Jim Baker and all this stuff. And I think Billy Graham was saying, you know what, I'll just make this rule. And then, like, there's a whole bunch of things that just can't happen if I have this rule. And Pence is doing the same thing, too. The problem, Kate, is that it turns women into this certain, you know, it almost turns women back into Eve, you know, this person who can get you in trouble and has to be treated in a particular way.
Yeah, it's a frightening thought to me, especially since Vice President Pence just broke the tie in the Senate to vote to defund the full range of reproductive health care to women. So I find the juxtaposition of the two stories to be rather alarming, personally and for the future of our country.
Well, and he seems decades behind the rest of the country in terms of normal human interaction and relations, right? I mean, he's like an Eagle Scout who never progressed beyond that, either emotionally or morally. That's the sense I get. I know it sounds judgmental, but I'm here to judge.
Well, what he's saying really is I can't be trusted, right?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, that's really what it is. It's like I can't control myself enough.
I have no impulse control.
I don't know. Yeah, so I agree with Colin. Colin is saying that it's something, saying something about women, that women are these alluring mm-hmm. evil creatures,
sirens,
will get you in trouble.
Who will always appear with a snake.
But
well,
but you're also, but if you felt about yourself that you had the capacity to just say no, mm-hmm. in Nancy Reagan's terms, you wouldn't have to have your chaperone with you all the time, right? Like,
or you wouldn't live in constant right. fear yeah. that you were going to fall.
Well, the real problem with it is that it's unfair and it's unequal. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. If Teresa is a lobbyist and I'm a lobbyist, mm-hmm. Mike Pence can meet with me, but he can't meet with Teresa. I mean, he can't mm-hmm. have dinner with Teresa. He can't be alone, you know. Or if we're Capitol staffers, mm-hmm. you know, whatever we are, I have much more access to Mike Pence because I'm not a problem. Teresa's
and you don't
a
have to make him a sandwich.
I don't have to make him a sandwich. So. To me, that's the problem. The problem is that it creates – it puts women in a class where mm-hmm. they can't have equal access to the vice
and
president.
And it dovetails with Kate's point that it is – does everything this guy does diminishes women.
Right. All right. Well, we have to take a break. We're going to come back. We're going to recommend some things to you. So stay tuned for that.
And the music's ended. Whoa, whoa, whoa. And that's not petty. As cool as I am, I thought you know this already. I will not be afraid of women. I will not be afraid of women.
This is your captain speaking. We're cruising at an altitude of 33,000 feet. I'm going to go ahead and turn off the fasten your seatbelt sign. And up here in the cockpit, I'm wearing Victoria Sport Anytime leggings. They're super soft and smooth. Stretch. I repeat, they are super soft and smooth with stretch. Today's show was produced by Jonathan McLeggings and me, Kyone Wolf. Amanda Fish is wearing tights. The part of Bill Curry was played by Karen Pence. We'll be back on Monday to scramble through the news of the weekend. And now, back to Colin.
All right. So, yes, and it's not McPants today. It's McLeggings. All right. So, but we're off leggings now. We're on to other things. We're on to recommendations of things. Who wants to go first? Teresa Kramer, what have you got for us?
I'll endorse a book I'm reading called Perfect Little World by Kevin Wilson. It's the story of a young single mother who gets sort of roped into this sort of communal child-raising experiment. And It struck a chord with me while listening to S-Town because one of the stories mentioned in that by a writer was A Rose for Emily, mm-hmm. and she's actually working on this project in the book that is also about A Rose for Emily, and it was just a weird thing that synced up at the right time, but I'm flying through this book.
Is it a novel or a nonfiction?
It's a novel. Mm-hmm. And also on the podcast front, Undisclosed, which is another sort of Serial spinoff, or it's something that people did in response to Serial. They are now doing a series on the killing of Freddie Gray, and it is the most granular look at this case I've ever seen, and it's really fascinating. There's probably a lot of stuff that people don't know, and I would really recommend listening to it.
And it's the name again?
It's Undisclosed, but it's specifically the episodes about the killing of Freddie Gray.
All right. Kate, what have you got for us?
All right. I am reading a book called More Than Petticoats, Remarkable Connecticut Women. I'm reading this because I'm teaching about our state heroine, Prudence Crandall, and it's very accessible, and I recommend it. And also in the popular history category, reading category, I just started All Souls, A Family Story from Southie, and that's by Michael Patrick McDonald. And my first teaching was at South Boston High, and so I have a special interest in it. And he's talking about how violence and drugs and gangsters and depression affected his family and his community. And he's also talking about the love. And I got to give a shout out. There's so much bad news in the news, but I just love the U.S. women's hockey team, that they did their job action and they won and they're getting paid and they're playing this weekend or tonight.
Hmm. All right. And Jim Chapdelaine.
I get a couple of things here. The Brain Injury Alliance of Connecticut is putting on an event on May 11th at the Pond House at Elizabeth Park with Kate Callahan and a little group called the Shinolas. And that's a Thursday, and it's for a good cause.
The Shinolas, I should say, are Jim's band, and they are great.
Secondly, I don't want to make this too personal, but Teresa and I are involved in a group called Indivisible, and we are sort of a clearinghouse for your resistance opportunities, and we appreciate your business. We've grown it from 0 people to 1,800 people in about 3 months, and we're very excited about it. It's a very it's a cool way to express your dissatisfaction. And in a micro way, there's a little thing you could do on your phone called ResistBot, where you dial 50409 and type the word resist, and it will prompt you, and it will send a letter to your House rep and your two senators on whatever you want, and it'll be there within seconds. And lastly, Dave Chappelle just dropped 2 new comedy specials on Netflix. One of them I find mind-blowingly good, the one that he did in Los Angeles. The second one is a little more scatological, but it's still really funny if you like Dave Chappelle. But the first one is mandatory viewing for challenging your views on race and everything else. But that's it. Dave Chappelle, he's on fire.
All right. So how do people find Indivisible and make sure they don't get the NPR show that runs in my old time slot?
Can't believe you guys stole our name, man.
I think the easiest way is if they went to indivisiblect.com, and then from there you can get to the Facebook group. You can get to other things.
Twitter.
Yeah. Indivisiblect.com.
Yep.
Or on Twitter, it's IndivisibleCT. On Facebook, IndivisibleCT. We have a closed group.
All right. So I'm going to quickly endorse the cartoons of Jack Ziegler, who died, I guess, last week. If you go to the New Yorker website, you can find an In Memoriam Jack Ziegler by Bob Mankoff, who's their cartoon editor. Jack Ziegler was one of my favorite New Yorker cartoonists. I just look at some of those cartoons. They'll make you laugh. Getting ready for an event about words, I discovered the Lingua Franca blog. It's on the it's part of the website of the Chronicle of Higher Education, which is chronicle.com. Lingua Franca has great contributors like Ben Yagoda and Lucy Ferris, who's on our show sometimes. It's just a great – if you like words and you like people pulling apart words and how they're being used, it's a great great resource for that, and nice little essays and stuff. And a lot of us – I recommended it on an email, and then everybody wound up reading it. There's a fairly long but very, very fast read by David Owen in the current issue of The New Yorker. It's about hearing aids and loss of hearing. David Owen is like my favorite New Yorker writer. He could make anything interesting and fun for me to read. I looked at this thing and I thought, do I really care about hearing aids? Well, it turns out I do, and I do care about hearing loss. And also, even if I didn't, David Owen would really make it interesting. So, I mean, I'm just such a David Owen fanboy. And then lastly, last night I saw Next to Normal, and I actually would probably need more time to say everything that I would like to say about this. It's at Theater Works. It's directed by Rob Ruggiero, who we know can really direct a musical. He's directed fabulous productions at The Good Speed, and here he is in his home theater doing... This is a difficult musical. First of all, it's about mental illness. It's about sort of really kind of the modern version of mental illness and treating it with strong pharmacology. It's also about so much more, though. It's about a family trying to stay together, about a woman trying to keep herself together. It's very much about the relationship between women and their sons, too. I think it gets more... of that accurately than almost anything that I can think of, and in a very weird way. There's sort of a spoiler with Next to Normal that I'm avoiding telling you about. But I'll also say that Theater Works is 190 seats, which is – I've seen the big kind of Broadway-style production. I saw it on the national tour with Alice Ripley, who became very famous for her performance in this role. Christiane Noel, I think, is the name of the woman playing it here. She's terrific. And in a 190-seat theater, you can really see her face. Her face is very expressive. This is an incredibly emotional work. Last night, people were crying at the end of the first act, and they were really crying in the second act. And it is a very moving I've now seen it twice, and both times I've been very emotional during the second act. So I'm really highly recommending this. Rob's done a great job with this. You don't usually think about the lighting very much, but the lighting design on this is spectacular. The set, which involves a kind of Lazy Susan turntable device, but also a lot of other stuff. The set's great, and the actors play a lot out in the audience. They're out in the audience, in the aisle space a lot. So it makes the theater, which is already small and intimate, seem even more small and intimate. So,
how does this run?
I think they've extended it through May, so people have time. But anyway, it's a great show, Next to Normal, and it's a tough show to stage. The music isn't wonderful the way, say, a Sondheim musical is or something. The music's kind of up and down. There's like four or five great songs and then a ton of songs that are almost like operatic recitatif. But I don't know. Somehow or other, it all pulls together and has a big emotional punch. All right. Well, thanks very much to all who helped out today, but especially our wonderful panel, poet Kate Rushen, musician Jim Chapdelaine, writer and editor Teresa Kramer. Will be back on Monday with The Scramble.
Hi, I'm Kyone Wolf. I'm here for my private dinner meeting with Mike Pence.
Sorry, miss. That won't be possible.
Hi, I'm Kyone Wolf. I'm here for my private dinner meeting with Mike Pence.
We'll send someone right down.